So I want to welcome everybody to See, Here's the Deal. I'm your host, Mario Gibson. My friends call me Rio. You are going to be witness to some pretty awesome conversations. These conversations are going to be between myself and, of course, our CEO and fearless leader, Mark Hulick. Sometimes we're going to be bringing in guests in our Vesta's leadership. I know that one episode is going to be featuring our fearless Miranda. I'm sure Mr. Ben Didier is going to pop in on an episode or two. Either way, what we want to do is teach you about Vesta, how it happened, where this idea came from, who this idea came from, and then the deals themselves. Sometimes we're going to be talking about deals that have already happened in the past. You know, we've been in existence for 7 years now. Sometimes it's going to be deals that just closed. Either way, I want these conversations to be fun. I want them to be exciting. I want them to be giving you the kind of information that, you know, can be helpful to you in understanding Vesta, and then understanding the multifamily world. So, without ado, this is my friend and yours, Mr. Mark Hewlett.
It's a pleasure to be here, Rio.
Thank you. So, I guess we should take it to the beginning.
Yeah, sure.
Refresh my memory. So, this story, setting this scene, the story starts in Kansas City. What year did we meet?
We met in 2013.
Yes.
Late 2013.
Yeah. I was trying to remember, was it 13 or 14? But,
yep.
But 13 actually sounds exactly right. So both of us being lovers of fine whiskeys and scotches and also fine cigars.
I have to say, a good cigar.
We found ourselves both being members of this cigar club in Kansas City called the Pendergast Club. Shout out to Pendergast. So now at this time in our lives, I could probably say with confidence that neither one of us had any business trying to be members of any kind of a club that you had to pay a membership fee to be part of. But we both did. We both were. We hit it off pretty famously right away, and then started having these conversations about life and growth.
Yep.
As a professional, growth as a man.
Yep.
You know, and then one day. I'm trying to remember if you got the opportunity to tell me or if I found out after it had already happened, which is what I think it was, that you had gotten a job. Let me pause. At the time, you were an assistant property manager.
Yeah, when I first joined the club, I was an assistant property manager in Lawrence, Kansas.
So
the club was about a 45-minute drive for me.
Right.
Which makes it even funnier membership to have.
Right.
But yeah. Yep.
So, like I said, one day I find out, I think you called me after it happened, that you had gotten a job in Austin.
So I went from property in Lawrence to another to managing a property in Lawrence for the same company, and then went to Austin.
Okay, so assistant to full PM.
Right.
than offer in Austin.
Right.
So was the offer in Austin a PM position as well?
Yeah, it was a little bit different structure. It was a general manager. Mm. So I had a larger staff underneath me. You know, typically in multifamily, you have, like, if you're a property manager, even a bigger property, but even, you know, particularly in the 200 to 300 unit space, you got like maybe five people that report to you, six people that report to you. I moved to Austin to be general manager for a student housing complex. And I had like, I think 15 people working under me.
Mm.
It's a lot bigger operation.
Okay.
Than kind of anything else I would have had exposure to.
Gotcha. So how long? So you went from GM, and so what's and what year is that?
So that was 2014.
Okay.
As GM.
So that was later.
Yeah. So like basically,
later 2014.
Basically, yeah. By 2015, they promoted me to like a regional manager.
Mm-hmm.
Then I met this guy. I met this guy at my rabbi's Shabbat dinner table. Super high net worth from Australia, who was buying multifamily in the U.S. Mm. and needed somebody to kind of, that knew multifamily space and could kind of run things. And, you know, I'm never one to shy away from something. Yeah. And I said, I could, you know, I can do that for you.
Yeah. So, yeah, as we always joke, you're not risk averse.
I'm not risk averse, right. So I said, I got that. Okay. So it took me about 6 months to get hired on with them. I went through, like, it was one of those companies that you interview not just with, like, one or two people, but had, like, multiple interviews, had to take an exam. You know, it was, like, a six-month process. And, by the way, you're dealing with overseas folks. Called by, you know, by the end of 2015, that I was solidly involved in, you know, transitioning to senior VP of multifamily for this Australian firm.
Okay. So once you're there and mm-hmm. you're in this position, and you're how old at this time?
Well, I guess in 15, I was 27.
Yeah, so.
Right? 26.
26, yeah. So really young
mm-hmm.
to have that level of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, you're definitely not a shrinking violet, so ready to step up to that challenge. Or am I wrong?
No, for sure. No, I you know, funny, I just felt like, you know, I had a lot of experience because I started in the industry when I was 18. So
Right.
You know, when you typically talk about somebody having, you know, 10 years experience, you'd think that that's a long time. So by the time I started Vesta, I had 10 years experience, ranging from a leasing agent to senior VP of multifamily. And so you look at that and you say, you know, and I remember, you know, early on investors, particularly in the first deal I was raising on, investors would say, aren't you too young?
Mm.
You know, well, I got 10 years experience.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, like how, but yeah, no, for sure. I mean, operations is one thing. Mm-hmm. So being a regional manager was one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when you transition into, you know, into being an SVP or you know, having your own firm, the finance side of the business is very different. So, you know, call it from like 2015 to 2017 was really about learning the finance world, learning how to buy properties, learning how to finance properties. And you know, that was a faster time becoming, you know, developing an expertise because, you know, when people invest with us, they expect us to be experts. And rightly so, right? If you're not an expert, they're gonna find somebody who is.
Yeah.
And very, so you gotta learn, gotta soak up knowledge and gotta come, you know, understand the world around you.
Yeah. So how long are you in the position before you make the decision that it's time to move on and start your own thing?
It didn't happen all at once. Mm-hmm. And I think the more I've talked to different people who were in similar positions, similar stories, I think that's kind of a common thing, right? It never happens all at once. It's not like you wake up one day and you're like, you know what? I'm in.
Okay.
For me, my boss was talking about, you know, we were looking at bigger cities, and my boss was talking about wanting to buy in bigger cities and the returns he was looking for. And I said, those are cap rates, you know, yield on cost and what matters, you know, kind of most to investors, you know, their returns, you know, their cash returns, their IRR returns, their equity multiples. They weren't, the markets he was looking at were too hot to be able to get those higher returns. So I said, hey, look, you know, I grew up in Kansas City. I lived in Oklahoma for a little bit. You know, those are the cities that you can, really make that sort of money in.
Right.
And, you know, that was interested in my idea. And thankfully for my career now, I got to take a trip through a lot of different tertiary markets. I went to, you know, Cleveland, Columbus, Ohio, Omaha, Nebraska, Des Moines, Iowa, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Kansas City, which I obviously was from, but spent time there. You spent a couple days there, not as a resident, but looking at the multifamily scene space. Okay. Then went down to Tulsa and Oklahoma City, and then got back to Austin.
Okay.
And, you know, leaving that trip, I was convinced that Tulsa and OKC were the best markets in the U.S. to put money into.
Okay.
And took that to the CEO, and he's interested, but he said there's no way he could get Australian capital interested in Oklahoma.
Hmm.
And you know, he said, basically, he said, look, I like it. If you can find American investors, I'll back your play.
Hmm.
And a lot of people, when I tell them that part of the story, they say, oh, I get it. So you said, if I'm doing all your property management,
right,
and I'm doing, you know, all of your acquisitions, if I can find American investors. And that wasn't exactly it. In late 2016, I started to meet, you know, I tried to meet people for the first time. I was actually trying to talk to people about working with the company I was working for.
Okay.
And it was kind of, I had my first conversation with a potential investor, and he was like, I'm interested in investing with you, not with this firm.
Mm.
And I was like, well, that doesn't help me at all, because I don't have my own thing.
Right.
All right. And then it was, you know, kind of January 2017 where I isolated my first deal and just felt like I couldn't do it with the firm I was at. Like, I had to go on my own.
Mm.
And so it was probably a four-month process of getting to that point where, you know, the thing is, and I've seen this now looking back, it's very hard to raise money for the first deal.
Mm.
However, if you know, back in 2016, the multifamily industry was so hot that lots of people were interested in starting and being on the ground floor in a real estate investment firm, right? That not necessarily just being an investor. But at that time, it was pretty easy to find somebody to back me. It was way easier to find someone to back me than to back the company I was working for.
Okay.
And so I realized by January that I didn't see coming, I could find someone to back me.
Okay.
I could find people to back me, but I couldn't find anyone to do the same for an already existing company, because, you know, the feeling was, look, I'll be your partner, I'll be your mentor, I'll be something to you.
Right.
But I'm not going to do that with a CEO of a you know, multi-billion dollar, gotcha, you know, okay, investment firm that's headquartered in Australia.
Okay.
And that was when I decided, okay, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. Okay. I'm going to do this on my own.
All right. So, you have the epiphany that not only is it time, but you can.
Yeah.
So from that moment to there actually being the first remnants of a Vesta.
Mm-hmm.
So how long is that?
It was really fast. Okay. So found our first property to look at in January, made an offer on it, went out to do a site inspection, and it was awful. Misrepresented.
Okay.
I still keep track of that deal.
Okay.
It's traded several times in the last 5-6 years.
Okay.
And no better than it was
okay.
back then.
Okay.
Won't name any names, but not the shining jewel of Tulsa.
All right.
And I had brought some early investors out to look at that deal. Actually, I thought, when we pulled up to the property and it was as bad as it looked, I thought for sure. I was like, oh, damn, this is...
Yeah.
These guys are never going to take me seriously. I'm going to call them and I'm going to tell them I got a deal, and they're going to be like, if it looks anything like that, that last thing you showed me, you know? And so thankfully that didn't happen. We all agreed that property was not worth buying. But the guy said to me, he said, well, is there anything else you have to show me in town?
Mm.
And there was a deal, Markeel Memorial in Bixby. For those of you not familiar with Bixby, it's a high-performing suburb, you know, fastest-growing suburb in the state of Oklahoma, at least back then, I still think probably. It had been on the market, but I thought someone had bought it.
Okay.
So I said, look, you know, there's this deal. I think someone's already gotten it under contract. I was looking at it. Really like it. And so we drove halfway across the city, got to it. Guy was like, I love this. Let's buy it. Okay. I'm like, well, you know.
Okay.
We got to see if we can get it.
Right.
So call the broker. Broker says, yeah, it's under contract. And I'm like, oh, okay, no problem. A couple weeks later, I get a call from broker. Broker says, it's out of contract.
Okay.
I thought that all the money would be coming from those people that toured with me the previous week. That ended up not being the case.
Mm.
So it was kind of that whole kind of process from January until June was figuring out how to buy this deal.
Mm. Okay.
And so we got under contract in February. We're supposed to close in March. We had to take a 30-day extension to April because I had to figure out how to raise the money. And then we had to take another 30-day extension to get into May. And... you know, the seller was real,
mm-hmm.
you know, right, real. Right. And then even the broker, who's now one of my best friends,
uh-huh.
at the time, you know, we never worked together before. And he's like, God, is this guy going to be able to follow through?
Right, right, right.
And, you know, this is at a time where people don't love giving extensions. Quite frankly, in today's world, they still don't love giving extensions.
Right, right, right.
And so I remember having to beg for a final extension, beg. Like, I can close this deal, but I need until June.
Okay.
And so we closed at the end of June. So I'd say January to June was all about just figuring out how to do this deal.
Okay.
And that was raise the money. That was, you know, we thought we'd go to Freddie Mac for our first loan. Mm. All right. And Freddie says, fantastic. Yeah, we're in. But you can't be the manager. What? Well, you have no experience. I got 10 years of experience.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Not as a sponsor.
Okay.
So they're like, you have to hire third-party property management, and we have to approve who that third-party property manager is going to be. And I'm like, well, that's my greatest expertise. That's what I bring to the table. Right, that's what right. I'm telling investors.
Right.
They can trust me with the property management because I know what I'm doing.
Right.
And, so then it was like, well, not going to Freddie Mac for the first
loan. Okay. Once again, refresh my memory. I think we're in Kansas City again, Pendergast Club, having the smoke, and you get a phone call, and you're proceeding to talk to someone about...
Are you talking about the fake phone call?
Well, what at the time, I didn't know was a fake
phone call. All right.
So, refresh my memory about the fake phone call.
Yeah. So it's funny how...
I'm trying to put all this into timeline context.
It's funny how life comes together, right?
Right.
2013, I joined a club that I could ill afford. And, 2017, mm-hmm. I'm using that same club to make fake phone calls so that people know the deal I'm raising money on is great, right? All right, so here's what happened. As Rio's talked about, this was a cigar and whiskey club that we both love to this day.
Yeah.
And it's like a home away from home. And I always loved it because I could go up, I could talk to Rio about life, about style, about fundraising, about anything. It was just, and you'd have a variety of different guys up there. It's the type of place where you don't call anyone ahead to say you're going, right? You just show up on a Tuesday night, and you're good with whoever's there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So very much how that place was.
I was there one night, and there was a guy who fancied himself a big real estate guy. And I heard him talking all night about a deal he was doing that was a 15 IRR and how excited his big investor was to do it.
Mm.
And I'm sitting here on a deal that on a pro forma basis was a 20 IRR. Mm. And I'm like, all right, if you're excited about a 15,
right.
How do I say this to them?
Right.
Now how do I say it to him?
Right.
And I'm just starting out, in today's world, I might just say, hey, if you're interested in a 15 IRR, boy, do I got a deal for you.
I got something for you.
Because I have credibility. But back then, I didn't have credibility.
Mm.
So I was thinking quickly. So I saw him sitting at the bar next to me and basically had a fake phone call.
Okay.
Where I excused myself in the bar, said, I'm getting a call, started walking around, walked back to my seat at the bar, and now talking of the returns to nobody other than
him.
Right. And I get off the phone.
Right.
The guy looks at me, he says, you got a deal that good? And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
And that was my first $500,000 investment. Biggest investment in that deal.
Okay.
That deal we had to raise $3,751,563. And
to this day, it still amazes me that you remember that number.
I always remember that number.
You remember that number to the penny.
I always remember that number, but yeah. So it was like, and at that time, I was kind of stuck. You know, my first partner, the guy and his son who had come to look at that first property with me, they had raised a nice amount starting out, but we were stuck.
Mm.
And so I was very much on my own at that point.
Okay.
And so I was, trying to figure out how to meet new people, and I didn't have a network. You know, it was something that I guess I'm particularly proud of, and it gets kind of misconstrued. When I meet somebody and I tell them, I'm 35 years old and I own 10,000 units of multifamily, there's basically two thoughts.
Right.
One, your parents started the company. Two, your parents gave you a lot of money. I didn't have a network. I didn't have family money. Certainly wasn't, business didn't exist before me.
Right.
And so when I say that we built a network out of like a fake phone call, my first investors were the fake phone call and a guy who I used to teach tennis for 6 out of his 8 kids.
Mm.
And so when I say I started, a network out of kind of thin air, that's what it was. And it's one of the things I'm most proud of.
Yes. And to tell you the truth, I think one of the things as your friend that I am as proud of as if I did it myself, because, even when I talk to people about, I work for, Vesta Realty and what I do, and that, somebody that I personally know owns the company, their first thoughts are the same. It's like either they had a bunch of money to begin with or family did. And I'm like, no, I'm like we're both guys that started from the bottom. Now we're here. So
yeah, I mean that's the fun part of the journey, though, right?
Yeah.
Is that still figuring things out.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny for me because I don't mind. I always coach myself. Hey, whatever somebody thinks of you, whatever. You
know? Mm-hmm.
So if somebody wants to say, "Oh, there's no way that's true."
Right.
But I'm like, all right, just whatever.
Right.
But there is that part of me that gets real fired up inside. Like, not give me credit. Actually, really funny story about this. I have a very close investor and friend.
Mm.
Who's been around some of our personal gatherings and personal, Hebrew word simchas, joyous events, whatever. And so this investor, who is, second generation family wealth, was talking to my little sister, and he was saying, which he said to me multiple times, your story is the American dream. Like, you started from nothing and now you're this like great, and so he says this to my sister,
right.
My little sister. Now, keep in mind, we were raised, we were raised going to private schools, but we were like not at the upper, right?
Yeah.
So my dad's a doctor, my mom's a lawyer. My mom didn't practice while we were growing up, and but my parents gave us a private school education, until I got out on my own, I didn't have to worry about like health insurance or a car, some of those basic needs, which, not downplaying, I mean, the ability to get started in the world with a working vehicle actually is a huge leg up. So not to say that I had no support.
Yeah, it's
just a scale, right?
Right.
So this guy tells my sister, "I'm so impressed, your brother did this all on his own."
Right.
And my sister doesn't think of it in the same terms as like on her own. She's like, "Well, he had my parents' help." And so the guy asked her, he's like, "Oh, I always thought your parents weren't able to help start the company." She goes, "Well, no, not start the company, but we've always had we had cars when we needed to get to work. We had health insurance until we could afford it on our own." And it was so funny to me because it shows you how there's really different levels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For somebody like him, that's still doing. You still did it on your own. And for what Vest has become, you still did it on your own.
Yeah.
But it was a good, to me, it was an interesting lesson on humility, too. Because, if I think back, right? I mean, every advantage that we have in the world can be a beautiful thing. You just don't want to waste it. And so when I look back, so grateful to the fact that, I never, I was able to get to where I was going, partially because Melanie's right. I did have, my parents couldn't fund a real estate company, but they could sure as hell make sure that I could get to work if I had trouble getting to work, or that I could, I'm type 1 diabetic, that I could afford my medicine.
Right.
And so it's an interesting lesson in being proud of who you are, what you've accomplished, but at the same time, humble enough to say, not everything is me.
Right.
Right. I had advantages. I had, whatever. Yeah. Stuff like that. So that's an interesting.
Yeah. No, having met your folks. First, phenomenal people.
We got to have them on the podcast.
Sometime. We actually do need to have them on the podcast.
Yeah, for sure.
Phenomenal people. I know your relationship with your dad is pretty special.
I met I had a new investor in the last deal we did, speaking of my dad, and guys from the same community that I grew up in. And so I introduced myself to this guy. I'm trying to talk to him about this deal, and he goes, "Oh, are you Eric Kulik's son?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "A buddy of mine used to go see your dad." My dad's a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst.
Mm-hmm.
It's buddy of mine used to go see your dad.
Mm.
And he said, when my buddy would go, we didn't say, he didn't say, "I'm going to a psychiatrist, I'm going to a therapist." He said, he used to say he was going to see his sage.
Mm.
And I was like, Yeah, I was so proud.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, like, so happy. Yeah.
That's awesome. I'm about to say, you guys is, the three of you, but in particular, your relationship with your dad is always been, well, I had a similar relationship with my pop, so I understand the closeness that you guys have. So, you're now getting some investors to get this deal going. So, fast forward, we've now gotten the money.
Mm-hmm.
We've gotten the deal going. So, I now know, well, I knew of this person then, but I now know them as Mrs. Mark Hewley. but at the time, she was far from Mrs. Mark Hewley. You guys weren't even dating. But how did you convince her to... I always say she was patient zero because she was definitely employee number one. So how did you convince her to leave the Kansas City area, come to Tulsa for a company that you weren't 1,000% sure was going to be around?
So actually, this predates the way you phrase that question. You were talking about how like. Deals funded, everything like that. Alicia came in the scene Investa way before that.
Oh, okay.
So in March of 2017, we just got under contract. I took a trip to New York to fundraise.
Okay.
While I was doing the fundraising, I was missing a whole bunch of stuff on due diligence. Keep in mind, I didn't have a team. It was just me.
Right.
And so I was like, I need an employee. And my first big investor, my first big partner, had given me a loan.
Okay.
And so, which is a whole interesting story in and of itself, how that transpired. But had given me a loan that I would pay back when the company started, you know, being successful or whatever.
Okay.
And I called him and I said, "Hey, I need a little more money. Because I need an employee."
Okay.
And I was interviewing a couple people that I had known. I wanted somebody that I knew personally. That was a goal. Because this person was going to be working hand in hand with me. This was at a very sensitive time. For me, I wanted somebody that I could have fun with. I wanted somebody that I could trust. I mean, all of those things were important. And so I had a couple interviews lined up. People that I knew, and then I looked on Facebook, and Alicia had posted on Facebook that she was looking for a new job, unhappy with where she was at, looking for a change. Anyone know anything? Let her know.
Okay.
Now, keep in mind, I had had a thing for Alicia. Damn, met her, right?
Right.
And I looked at that, and I was like, "Well, I got a job," and. I always tell people that my first thought was, I don't know if the company is going to be successful or not, but if I get a date with Alicia out of it, even the attempt's worth it.
There you go.
You know?
There you go.
So
once again, not risk averse.
Not risk averse. So I hit Alicia up, and I'm totally honest with her, right? Mm-hmm. I own a real estate investment firm with no properties. I own a property management company with no properties.
Okay.
I will not live in Kansas City, because if the company is successful, it's based in Tulsa.
Okay.
So basically, and I can pay you for 3 months. I got enough of a loan to pay you for 3 months.
Okay.
Can't promise anything past that.
Okay.
She goes, couple things. One, she wanted my approval to be able to apply for other jobs.
Okay.
While she worked for me. Totally fair, right?
Right.
Other thing was, if the company was successful, she wanted 2 weeks off every December. Because that's what she had at a previous job.
Okay.
So first of all, I'm sitting there like, absolutely, you can interview for other jobs.
Right, right, right.
If this doesn't work out, I don't want you to be,
right.
You know, have all your eggs in my basket
right,
anyway.
Right, right.
And if this thing works out, you can have a whole freaking month off. What do I care, you know?
Right, right, right.
You know? And yeah, so So, she works for me.
Right.
We have a great relationship together. We never started dating, which was sad to me. but we were really close. She was so good for the business. Like, she was the first person that started working with investors. Mm. She would help orchestrate my schedule. She'd show up for due diligence stuff. I mean, it was really like a game changer having her on board. I felt like totally reinvigorated having her on board. And so when I tell people in today's world that she and I built this together, we really did. Mm-hmm. She missed basically all the lead up to Vesta and the first month. Mm. But everything else she's been directly a part of. and so now, fast forward, we raised all the money. It's time to move. It's time to go down to Tulsa.
Okay.
And she at first didn't want to come. And I took her on a trip to Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
And OKC, we went to a Thunder game in OKC, showed her, you know, some real estate in Tulsa, and we had a great time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was in May. She okay. was like interested. Okay. And then in like a week before close, I was anticipating going without her.
Mm.
And about a week before close, she was like, "You know what? I'll move to Tulsa." Now,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, that was how that happened. So, what convinced her? I don't know. I mean, I'd love to tell you. It was that she felt the same way I did.
Right.
I don't know if that's the case. I think she was really proud of what we were building.
Right.
We got along so well. That made it better, obviously. Okay. And, you know, I think new opportunities are exciting for people that are more risk averse than I am. I've seen this now so many times. New opportunities are exciting, but they're kind of ambivalent. People are ambivalent to them. Whereas I'm like, oh, new opportunity, I'm in, let's go. Okay. You know, I mean, I moved to Austin. You referenced that story. I got offered that job on Friday, and I moved on Saturday. And that was from Kansas City to Austin. So, like, I'll run with it.
Yeah.
And I recognize a lot of people aren't like that. So, Alicia, I think it just took a little bit of time for her to say, I'm going to do it. And then when she got to Tulsa, she would tell me, I don't know if I'm here for forever. I might be here for 6 months. I might be here for a year.
Right.
And there were a couple of times where I thought, she might end up heading back.
Okay.
By nothing but luck and divine providence, she not only stayed, but ended up marrying me.
There you go. So, you, patient zero, the property. If you notice.
We had one other person with us. Jeremy.
Yes.
Jeremy was not working for Vesta, but Jeremy had a turn company that he basically was going to do all of our turns, which he had been doing anyway for the previous year to 2 years.
Right.
And so Jeremy, who's another friend of mine, Jeremy moved with us.
Right. So you actually leave Kansas City with two people in tow.
Mm-hmm.
Two people, which are not only still here, but still intricately involved in the Vesta story.
Yeah, Jeremy now actually works. I mean, Jeremy had his own thing until 2018 that worked concurrently with Vesta.
Okay.
But in 2018, we just ended up hiring him directly.
Okay. All right. So, which gets me to... which gets me to the starting five, I like to call it.
Starting five, I like that.
So if your wife now is patient zero, I like to call her, the starting five. So you, you're now wife, Jeremy, Miranda.
Miranda comes by, still in 2017, but Miranda comes by at the end of 2017.
Okay. And is it Chris?
Yeah, Chris comes in at start of 2018.
Okay.
So Chris is Miranda's brother.
Right.
And we loved Miranda. I mean, Miranda really, she's now our chief investment officer, but Miranda really was first, and I wrote For anybody that's seen my first blog post, Miranda was featured in my first blog post. Miranda was very close to me.
Good writing, by the way.
Thank you.
just aside. Good writing, by the way.
So Miranda was our first, you know, kind of leadership level hire. And Miranda says, hey, I want you to interview my brother.
Mm.
And I'm real small company, very worried about not only nepotism, but like, if I have to fire your brother, I want to lose you too.
Right.
Type of deal.
Right.
And so I said, yeah, you know, I really, really don't want to hire. I don't want to meet your brother. No offense. He might be great. But. And Miranda convinced me just to have Thai food with him. Because back then I used to hire everybody at Lana Thai, a little Thai restaurant in Tulsa. And she said, you know, just take him out for Thai food. Nothing else. You'll love the guy. He's a really nice guy.
Right.
And Chris is the type of guy that lights up any room he's in.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just hard not to smile when Chris is
there. Yeah, I was about to say, I concur.
And so I sit down with him, and it's just light.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I get the feeling that he's a hard worker. You never know in an interview. Right? Right. In an interview, people can pretend to be a hard worker. People can think they're a hard worker. But you really never know.
Right.
But I get the feeling that he's a hard worker. I get the feeling that he's going to be a great addition to our team. So I decided to offer him the job.
Okay.
And, yeah, I mean, he still to this day lights up every room.
Yeah. So, so talk about you and the starting five in this apartment.
Yeah, so our first office, the original Vesta corporate office.
Right.
The Vesta World Headquarters, as we like to call it back then, was a two-bedroom apartment at Marquee.
Okay.
We didn't charge ourselves max rent. We still, because we have investors, and we didn't give ourselves a huge discount, but we gave ourselves the fighting,
all right,
you know, fighting 10% discount.
There you go.
And it was just enough space for us. It was perfect. I had my office in the master, and I guess primary. Miranda had the secondary as her office. And Chris and Alicia, so funny, they bonded almost immediately.
Right.
I mean, we talk about why Alicia stayed.
Yeah.
Before staying for me, it was that Chris became her best friend.
Right.
And so Chris and Alicia had basically this setup where they had two desks together.
Okay.
And it got to the point where Miranda and I started considering them like the same person.
Right.
So it would be like, hey, have you asked Alicia and Chris to do this?
Right.
Can you get, you know,
okay,
you know, can we check in with Chris and Alicia and see how they're doing with this task?
Right.
And that's what it was. We called them Alicia and Chris in the corner.
Okay.
And that was how they were. Jeremy didn't have an office in that space because he was doing unit turns.
Right.
So he didn't really need an office.
Right. And he was still working for himself.
Right. But you know, again, he was still involved, like still worked hand in hand with us.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically like having an independent contractor that's part of the team. You know, we wanted him to be able to grow his team out. We didn't want to be responsible for his people, whatever. But he was definitely part of the team at that time, and an essential part of our strategy on how to cut money on turnover costs. So Jeremy was definitely important, but yeah, he didn't have an office and wasn't officially was the only person that wasn't on the Vesta payroll.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean that original office was so much fun. I mean we had a lot of jokes. We had a good time.
Right.
And we even brought a couple early investors into the office to show them, you know, it's such a different thing now, right? Now between all of our corporate offices, I think we have about 80 corporate employees, which is Tulsa, Oklahoma City, and Kansas City.
Right.
And in Kansas City, as you all know, there's only four people.
Right.
So most of that's Tulsa and OKC.
Right.
But it's so funny now because now showing investors, new investors, our office. That's a big deal. Mm-hmm. You know, I want you to meet the people. You're walking around. You know, this person does this. This person does that. But back then, it was just us.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we even brought a couple investors, early investors, into that space. And they, you know, for the people that kind of know us as that time,
right.
You know, the growth is even more impressive.
So I know that we start. Okay, so what was it about Marquee? What was it about that deal?
You know, I've always, from an underwriting perspective, because if every deal starts with underwriting, right? I mean, there might be some deals that are just so badly, look so bad from the exterior that you wouldn't, you know.
Right.
I mean, there's a deal that's been floating around Tulsa for the last 4 years, and it's literally a deal that if someone gave to me for free, I'd have to say no.
Oh, wow.
But when you get to most deals, most deals are attractive at a certain price.
Okay.
And so Marquee was attractive physically, built in 2010.
Okay.
You know, I like telling investors that the initial developer spent so much money on it, overspent on it, that they put granite windowsills, which is true.
Oh, wow.
Marquee had granite windowsills. So we looked at it as kind of overdeveloped, right?
Right.
And they were never able to get the rent, so they sold it to somebody else, and they kind of didn't get the price they wanted. We were buying it from the guys that bought it from them. And it's actually, you know, a lesson I've learned is that when somebody overpays for something up front, when they sell it, usually somebody has to overpay to get them out.
Okay.
And then you know, every step along the way, you end up having to overpay more whenever you jump on that train.
Gotcha.
I love buying deals that underperformed early.
Oh, okay.
Because that means that, you know, they never got to their full value. So now we can, you know, we have a better value proposition. So I like that. I liked all of that. It was a beautiful property. It was in a good location. And you know, from the numbers, what they were asking made a lot of sense. I mean, it felt like what they were asking. And, you know, you're talking granite countertops, granite windowsills, 2010 vintage property, and I think they were getting like 82 cents a square foot on rent.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so if you think about today, that same property, which we sold it last year, or late 2022, I don't know exactly what they're getting anymore, but I'd imagine they're getting north of $1.15, $1.20 on per square foot on rent. So in 2017, we bought it at 85 cents or 82 cents a square foot or 83 cents a square foot, whatever they were charging. You have to love that.
Yeah.
I mean, look, and I still think that paying attention to what somebody's charging on rent is one of the most key parts of there's a deal we're offering to investors in the coming months. And one of the things I love about it is that, you know, current rents are 70 cents a square foot. And my performance, you know, granted, this is workforce housing, but my performa is we get to 85 cents a square foot. You always have to measure, like, how realistic, you know, if I tell you we can get to, you know, every deal is going to look great.
Right.
If you start at 70 cents a square foot on rent and you charge $1.50.
Right, right.
That's not realistic.
Though. Right.
So at Marquee, it was the first time we learned that. It was the first time we executed, not learned. I learned that lesson the year before.
Okay.
Working from, you know, working for the Australian.
For the Australian, right.
But first time executing it for myself.
Okay.
You know, Marquee was a great way to do it. Because I gotta tell investors, look, I mean, I'm just taking this thing to 95 cents a square foot.
Okay.
That's all if you believe I can get there,
okay,
then this deal's as good as I advertise.
Okay.
If you believe I can get past that. Because when we sold Marquee, I think our rents were about $1.05 a square foot. It's what kind of how I always tell investors to look at things. Like, you got to really look at the underlying assumptions, because spreadsheets can lie. You can make a spreadsheet say whatever the hell you want it to say.
Right.
So what you really got to look at is on the base assumptions. What does it take for me to get this? You know, If I have to get 10% rent growth every year to hit a pro forma, I'm not going to get it.
Okay.
Right? But if I only have to get 2% rent growth.
Okay.
Now it's a different story.
Yeah, okay. Makes sense.
But I think Marquee, in hindsight, was the perfect first deal.
Okay.
It looked pretty. It established us as being able to pick off a good deal. We got it at an opportunistic time because interest rates were rising in early 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people got kind of squeamish on buying. But when you fix an interest rate, you really don't have to worry about it. So we fixed, we looked at it and we said, well, look, it was worth, we bought it for $13.5 million.
Right.
They had initially gone to market asking for $14.4 million. And when rates rose, obviously the price is going to fall.
Right.
But from my perspective, we were compensated for that. And so whereas a lot of other people, it's a tertiary part of Oklahoma, which is already a tertiary market. I'm not interested because of that. Rates are increasing and I'm not interested because of that.
Okay.
We looked at that and said, well, look, we're being compensated.
Okay.
And at the base, we love this deal. So in hindsight, it was perfect. It established us as being able to find good deals. Mm-hmm. It was pretty, it was everything you'd probably want in your first deal.
Okay. All right. So what did you say that y'all purchased it for at the time?
We purchased it for $13.5
million. And sold it for?
I don't typically publicize.
Okay. All right, fair enough.
What we sold it for?
Fair enough.
We sold it for a nice profit.
But and that's all I need to know. But I'd say so. Which, actually, the reason I was asking is, you've often said, you make money. I'm trying to remember how you phrase.
You make your money when you buy.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. One of the only few people, not my parents, who I would consider a mentor, said to me very early on when I started investing, you make your money when you buy. And it made sense to me. But I kind of thought it was obvious. I kind of thought everybody would understand that. And I think it was about a year ago, I said that to a potential new investor, and they said, you mean when you sell? You make your money when you sell.
Right, right.
I said, No, you make your money when you buy. So if you buy at a good basis,
if you're buying the right thing,
the winds can change, the weather can change, and it's one of those things that investors invest with us for a number of different reasons. But there are people that invest as kind of an annuity and they look for cash flow. And we do our best to deliver cash flow in every environment possible. But I would say there are some deals, realistically speaking, that aren't able to cash flow like we project for one reason or another.
Okay.
The most important thing you can do to hedge that is make your money when you buy. Because if you think like that, you can weather any storm. You can go through a 2-year period without distributing. And this happened to us on one of the deals we sold in Little Rock. We went through a 2-year period where we were unable to make one distribution. And our investors made greater than double their money when we sold.
Okay.
Because when we bought it, we did our homework. We said, look, we bought that deal at 40, I think it was like 48,000 a unit.
Mm.
And we looked at it and we were like, okay, building next door from us just traded for 55 to 60. That building next door to them just traded in that same range. So we looked at that and said, well, we're getting a discount. Now, granted, we have to put some work into this property, but right down the street, they're getting more. So we knew that we had implicit value the day we bought the property. And you still have to do your best for cash flow because a lot of investors expect it. But the truth is that as a steward of other people's capital, running a real estate investment firm, we have to both plan for best case scenario, base case scenario, and worst case scenario.
Right.
And when you take the approach of you make your money when you buy, you're covered on the worst case.
Okay.
And now you got to figure out what's my best case and what's my base case.
Okay. Okay.
So, and by the way, if you told everybody that worst case scenario we're going to 2x your investment, we'd have more money. we'd have more money coming in than Blackstone right now.
Okay. So I think this is a great way to start this podcast series. So what we want to do every month is bring you the people and the deals that are building this thing called Vesta. So my name is Mario Gibson. This is Mark Kulick. And see, here's the deal. We'll see you guys next time.